watching the Super Bowl, dare I say it, it's a bit like having a colonoscopy, which is to say that you have this really long, extended, excruciating preparation, and then the event itself is an anticlimax. It's painless and it's quick, and before you know it, it's over. But the build-up is so painful.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is the latest of my Super Bowl special episodes, which I produce every time my Kansas City Chiefs make it to the big game. Or at least I did so back in 2020, 2023, and 2024. I've linked all of those Super Bowl episodes in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. As it happens, the only time I didn't produce a Super Bowl episode in tandem with the Chiefs' appearance was 2021, when they lost to Tom Brady's Buccaneers, which means I'm pretty much obligated to create this year's episode out of superstition alone. You might say this podcast ritual is a superstitious sports variation of Pascal's Wager, if you get that philosophical reference. Joining me in this year's Super Bowl discussion is the great Pico Iyer, who's long been one of my travel writing heroes. My decision to talk NFL football with Pico is a side effect of my interview with him last month when, in an outtake that didn't quite make it into the final episode, I told Pico and my wife Kiki that the Baltimore Ravens mascot is a literary reference to Baltimore native Edgar Allan Poe.
I didn't know that. I never put the two and two together. It's unbelievable.
Pico, I think it's the only pro sports team with a deep literary reference. You can help me think of this.
I'm married to a real bro.
Well, I'm a would-be bro. And I'm really glad that the Ravens have Derrick Henry. I've been watching them all season. But I never realized that. That's genius. Whoever came up with that is wonderful.
I kind of hate how this is justifying your love of football because Pico likes football. I'm going to see it a little differently now.
After that conversation, I emailed Pico and asked him if he wanted to be my podcast guest if the Chiefs made it to the Super Bowl again this year. Of course, there are hundreds of podcast episodes dissecting the Super Bowl around this time of year, but I'd like to think that this is the only one featuring professional travel writers instead of actual sports experts. Imagine NFL color commentators Tony Romo and Chris Collinsworth talking about travel literature for 30 minutes, and you'll get a sense for just how novel it is to listen in on Pico and me talking about the Super Bowl. Along the way, we talk about how Pico got interested in NFL football while listening to the very first Super Bowl on the radio when he was in boarding school in England at age 9. We talk about how Pico starts each morning in Japan around this time of year by watching NFL highlights on YouTube. We talk about how one of his guilty pleasures is reading sports autobiographies. Our conversation veers into the narrative power of sports fandom, at times also touching on the Olympics and Major League Baseball. At one point, I talk about my public radio segment about watching the Super Bowl overseas that I reported from Thailand way back in 2002. I've added that old segment in full at the very end of this episode. As for this year's Super Bowl chat, it's basically 30 unedited minutes of Pico and me enthusing about the pleasures of following sports. And before we started, we both swore we wouldn't get too deep into the specifics of this year's NFL season, since neither of us are sports experts. But we broke that vow several times, including Pico making his prediction for who will win this year's game between the Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles. We start by talking about the novelty of two travel writers analyzing a major American sporting event. Let's listen in. It's very exciting to be talking about Super Bowl. I'd like to think maybe I'm the first person to interview you exclusively about NFL football, Pico.
Exactly. It's funny, Ralph. Yesterday, somebody was telling me, I've done a lot of interviews around my new book, A Flame, and around fires and the like. But the most important and the most much anticipated interview was this one.
Fantastic. You know, it's almost an accident that I realized that you're an NFL fan, because in our previous interview about A Flame, I just randomly threw out that I had watched the Super Bowl in India, and that the guru who took me to the internet cafe knew that the Baltimore Ravens was a literary reference. And then you very knowledgeably spoke about Derrick Henry and Jared Goff. And it's like, oh my gosh, Pico is an NFL fan. So
yeah. And we'd spent the previous hour talking about Thomas Merton and Richard Rohr and the Buddha. And so it's a good transition. And you told me what I never knew, which is the Baltimore Ravens That refers to Edgar Allan Poe's poem. So now I'm going to have to rethink my distrust of that team.
right. Yeah. No, you'd mentioned that, and it's interesting. You mentioned being a Detroit Lions fan, and I'm fond of the Detroit Lions as well. Obviously, I'm going to choose the Kansas City Chiefs every time. But you said your money was on Jared Goff and the Lions, and I guess you would have lost the money had you actually bet that. So.
Yeah, and the rest of my money would have been on the Buffalo Bills. So it's lucky that I'm not a pro football pundit. And, you know, I think what I love about the Lions is that they've been so underrated and they were so ill-starred for a long time. It seemed every week there'd be a 56-yard field goal with 2 seconds left that would defeat them. And watching them go down the field is the most exciting thing in football currently. And I would say Josh Allen and the Bills is the second most exciting. Your team always wins in eccentric ways, but they're not dazzling to watch.
Well, I think wins in eccentric ways is the definition of the Chiefs' 2024 season. It's just been a very strange year. And, you know, as a fan, I'll take it however we get it. But it was interesting to watch. I'm also I like Josh Allen. I can't root for his team because his team always plays my team, and my team always wins. But it was he had a remarkable AFC Championship game.
Yes, and I think his team usually wins even against yours in the regular season, but always loses in the big games. But they're always such exciting games. I mean, I always feel those are really the two teams that I want to be watching most.
Yeah. Well, let's rewind all the way back from the year 2025, all the way back to your earliest memories of watching the NFL. How did it capture your imagination? I'm not super surprised that it's captured your imagination because you've written very eloquently about baseball in Japan. But tell me about your relationship with NFL football.
Well, Rolf, I'm so old. You know, I'm older than you. I can remember the first game 58 years ago. I was a little, my parents were living here in California in this house, but I was a little nine-year-old kid in England at boarding school where everything was illegal except the inedible food. And I was really homesick. And the one way that I could keep contact with the U.S. was listening to sports broadcasts on American Armed Forces Network, broadcasting from Germany, where American troops were. So literally, the first Super Bowl found me huddled under my bedclothes with an illegal transistor radio, which is what one listened to in those days, about this big, and the crackling call from Germany of Max McGee winning the game with a touchdown from Bart Starr. And it's amazing because like most Super Bowls, it was a very disappointing game. But I remember it 58 years later because of the position it held in my life. And it was the sort of lifesaver. And I still remember Max McGee's name, as you can tell, even though I don't think he's in the Hall of Fame or ever will be. And then I think probably the second year when the Packers played the Oakland Raiders, I followed. And like you, because I travel a lot, my life has often forced me to watch the Super Bowl in unlikely circumstances.
Yeah, no, I've watched the Super Bowl in Namibia. You know, the year that Tom Brady came back against the Falcons, I was in Namibia. It's just remarkable. I did a piece for National Public Radio in 2002 about trying to find the game in Thailand. This was back, I think it was the Rams and the Patriots, back when the Patriots were first starting their dynasty. I've been on record, I guess, for more than two decades now, Pico, as a guy who has been trying to find the game. So has it been a steady thing ever since you were under the covers listening to the first Super Bowl? Do you always seek it out, or does it come and go, your interest in the Super Bowl?
I do sort of seek it out. You know, I think when you were in Thailand in 2002, I might have been in Hanoi with my wife, waking up at 4 a.m. to see it in the bar of our hotel. Even though the Super Bowl is a perennial anticlimax. You know, I was thinking, in answer to your question, ever since I was a little boy, I always tried to watch the Super Bowl and the Academy Awards. And both, every year almost, huge anticlimax. They're always a disappointment, partly because the hype is so intense and so protracted. So thinking today, watching the Super Bowl, dare I say it, it's a bit like having a colonoscopy. Which is to say that you have this really long, extended, excruciating preparation. And then the event itself is an anticlimax. It's painless and it's quick, and before you know it, it's over. But the build-up is so painful. And same with the Academy Awards, probably more of an anticlimax. I will say the Tom Brady victory, I think, was the most exciting Super Bowl I've ever seen. That one, I actually got my daughter in Kyoto to sign me up to some Japanese sports streaming service for a month so I could watch the game. And happily, that wasn't wasted, because it was an astonishing game. I was supporting the Patriots in that game just because I'm not a fan of Atlanta. It was exhilarating. I mean, how did you feel about that comeback?
Well, I actually turned it on late. And so like the Falcons were up by like 21 yes. points when yeah. I turned yes, on, yes. when I turned it on. It's like, and you know, I'm a little bit sentimental for teams that don't quite have the accolades, right? So, yeah. I mean, that's why I like the Lions. The Lions haven't been a championship team since the 1950s. And the Falcons, you know, just have a very unglamorous record. And so I thought, well, maybe this is their year. But then it was so exciting to watch the comeback. You know, it was just, it felt inevitable. And it's funny, Pico, you're saying, I watched the Tom Brady victory. It's like, well, which Tom Brady victory before you specified the Falcons? Just because there's so many Tom Brady victories.
In fact, his victory with Tampa Bay was perhaps even more extraordinary, because that was his putting his stamp on his historical status. I don't need the Patriots. I don't need a dynasty. I don't need Belichick. I can do it by myself.
Well, that game really alarmed my wife, Kiki, because it was our first year together and we were watching the game. And of course, I'm a Chiefs fan, and it just did not go well for the Chiefs. The offensive line was injured. Mahomes had no time in the pocket. And at halftime, I just went and sulked in my bedroom. And I think Kiki had never seen me react emotionally to a sports game like this before. And so she still gives me a hard time that in a certain sense, I was the man in his 50s watching the Super Bowl. But I was also a five-year-old boy who was sort of emotionally upset that his team was not doing well against this great quarterback, Tom Brady. So
I think maybe that's what made your marriage possible and successful. She saw you vulnerable and she saw you in that broken moment. Now, as you know, I live in a little two-room apartment in nowhere, Japan. So our exposure to the world is very qualified and mediated. So I never follow politics because I think nothing good is going to come of that. But I do religiously watch the NFL over breakfast every morning, the YouTube highlights, because as your story suggests, I think sports is a great way of getting out all our emotions without taking it too seriously, ideally. I mean, there are football hooligans and things who are pretty violent, but you and I getting all those emotions out in the bathtub, but not in terms of Trump versus Kamala Harris, but in terms of the Chiefs versus the Patriots. And I think that's a much better way to do it, a good outlet.
It is. And, you know, I feel like I've read before that you almost consider sports, but NFL, sort of a respite from work. Is this true? I mean, because it's sort of for me, too, there's something almost therapeutic. Baseball is the same way. And again, this is something that my wife witnesses, you know, that I'll just be watching Royals highlights or Chiefs highlights, sort of for the information and the entertainment, but also because I'm not in work mode. I'm not trying to accomplish anything, but just sort of enjoying a moment. Do you have a similar relationship with sports?
Yes, absolutely. On two sides of the day. So I wake up very early, 4:30 in the morning, and I'm having my breakfast in the pre-dawn dark before going to my desk to write for 5 hours. And the ideal way into my day is while I'm enjoying the tasty Japanese bread to watch the NFL highlights. And when it's not football season, I watch tennis. And then at the end of the day, and here my wife gets a little upset, I'm really zonked after being at my desk all day. And so maybe at 7 o'clock in the evening, I just want to tune out and get ready to sleep. And so I start watching tennis again. And she said, why aren't you talking to me? Or why aren't we watching something together? She's Japanese, so she's clever enough. Now she watches the tennis with me. And so it's something we can share. But I think it serves exactly that function.
Do you have any NFL friends? Do you have any friends that you bond over with NFL, or is it more of a solitary ritual for you?
Very solitary, especially in living in rural Japan. So this is why this talk is so exciting to me. I don't think any of my friends really know I follow the NFL, and you're probably one of the few friends I can talk about it with. And then I'm remembering, as I sit here and I'm looking down over the University of California campus here in Santa Barbara, so the 49ers used to do their training camp here. And so when I was actually 9 years old, 10 years old, at the time I was began watching the Super Bowl, I would go down with my little autograph book and stand there and get John Brody's autograph. And it was so exciting. In those days, I mean, there was no security. There was nothing to separate these professional players from us. And so here it is more than 50 years on. I still like the 49ers, but probably the foundation for that was set by those childhood days. Training camps are a great thing in that way.
Huh. Do you have a favorite team in the NFL?
I've been liking the 49ers a lot, partly because of their uniforms, partly because of their history. You know, Joe Montana, I think, was the greatest player I've seen. And then Steve Young after that. I love Brock Purdy. So I keep on thinking, here's the next Tom Brady. It didn't work out this year, but I love, you know, he's so calm. I read a couple of years ago, somebody said, you know, he's the guy that you want your daughter to bring home as her date. And, you know, he looks like such a sort of law-abiding, mild-mannered, meek guy, which makes his accomplishments on the field even more spectacular. I mean, if you put him next to George Kittle and Debo Samuel and Ayuk, in fact, you can't put them all in the same place. Brock Purdy should be up at the top of the stadium watching those guys. So I do like the 49ers. And I was going to ask you, you know, you and I are not professional pundits. I know a lot of pundits talking for the next 12 days about this. But my feeling is that very quickly now, because we have a shortened attention span, we quickly denominate so-and-so as the greatest player ever. And I'm wondering who your pick would be for the GOAT. Because people are going to be talking about Mahomes even more if he wins this coming game. And I know you're a Chiefs fan, but what do you think?
Well, I am... it's funny. I like to talk to you about the geography of fandom, because of course I love Mahomes, because even before he was a starter, Chiefs fans were very excited about him. And I follow Chiefs and Royals fans on Twitter. So I sort of figured out that he was really good because people were so excited about him. But as I think I mentioned to you before, I went to high school with Barry Sanders. He was 3 years ahead of me at Wichita North High School. And like my mom was his first grade substitute teacher, and I know his sisters. And so I can't think that anybody is better than Barry Sanders, because, and this is a true story, I don't know if anybody in my podcast audience knows this. When I was a kindergartner, every spring we'd have field day, and they'd have races and jump rope competitions and pull-up competitions. And I was very fast. I won the 25-yard dash for kindergarten. But I remember that the whole playground stopped and everybody pointed over at this third grader who won like the 100-yard dash by 75 yards. It was just insane. And that was young Barry Sanders. So I don't know if I can be objective about this, that I think Barry Sanders is the best. He's a great guy. His family's really good. And he's a decent human, and he's a fantastic athlete. And so I can't even fairly answer that question. Do you have a favorite all-time player, Pico?
You know, I love that, Rolf. I'm really, really envious. And he seemed to a spectator, such a sweet guy and so dazzling. He and Walter Payton among running backs. You know, I will sometimes watch Barry Sanders's, you know, highlight reels and things on YouTube, because it's just so dazzling to see him slither through. Another reason to be supporting the Lions, I guess. So for me, if I were asked greatest player ever, I probably would choose Tom Brady, but with Joe Montana a close second. But I think my larger feeling, not just in the context of football, but everything, is we choose who is the guy right now, and we have no historical sense. And we forget that you know, people like Montana are pretty remarkable. And talk about Mr. Cool. As you know, I joined Time Magazine when I was in my mid-20s. And I think one reason I joined the magazine, it was a couple of months before I had my interview, they had Joe Montana on the cover, and they chose that particular picture because there was just a little smudge of dirt on his uniform, which made him look even cooler, but reminded you he was gritty and he was, you know, down to earth and ready to get into the brutal stuff. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, okay, these guys are in the right place. I'm happy to join them. But Brady's figures are hard to argue with. I mean, when Mahomes wins 7 Super Bowls, then I think we can start to talk about him.
Yeah, no, that was why I was so astonishing that he won his 7th against Mahomes a few years ago. Yeah, you mentioned Time Magazine. I'm curious to know where you got your information about the NFL. I think young people don't realize that there was a time when you had to get magazines, newspapers, or books, or stay up late to watch the TV news to learn about football. So was your knowledge of the NFL sort of limited to hearing about Max McGee on the radio, or did you do your own research when you were a young man?
I'm so glad you asked that, Roth. Yes, so I probably like you, I religiously read actually Sport Magazine and even more Sports Illustrated. And working in the Time Life building, I would say nearly all of us at Time idolized the writers at Sports Illustrated. And I've always felt that sports writers are probably the best writers in journalism because they're often writing about an event that whose result everybody knows already. So they have to be stylish and witty and imaginative to hold our attention. And they are. And I will tell you in particular that as a little boy, I really had only one dream in life. And that was to get into Sports Illustrated, to have one piece in Sports Illustrated. And when I was at Time, because I was just a few floors under Sports Illustrated, I wrote a piece about the field game, which is a very eccentric English game that was played only in my high school. So I thought, I'm pretty much the only guy who's ever going to write to them about the field game and the wall game. And they rejected it. But you know how perseverance pays off as a journalist. Maybe 15 years later, after I'd written some books, I sent them the same piece and they accepted it. So I have had one piece in Sports Illustrated, but you had a really long feature. And I think I have looked at you with, you know, even more respect and admiration and envy after you did a long piece for Sports Illustrated, because I think, to me, Sports Illustrated is a more impressive achievement than The New Yorker. I mean, I think that's the great writer's magazine. It was, less so now, obviously, but certainly when I was growing up. So I would, like you, I would follow the results probably on in the newspaper or on the evening news, but then I would read about them to just get into the whole imaginative world of sports through SI.
Yeah, no, I think my Sports Illustrated story, it was also sort of a true crime story. It was about a very tragic murder that happened in small college football players in Kansas. But I think narrative has always attached itself, for over 100 years now, narrative has attached itself to sports. There was I've forgotten his name. There was an author about 100 years ago who would write football stories for boys. And the sportscasters sort of stole his way of really dramatizing the game. Instead of just sort of being dry and statistical, really talking about human interest things. And I know that you're a fan of the Olympics, and the Olympics is sort of famously dogged at telling the story that underpinning each of the sporting events. And so I just wonder, you're a guy who deals in narrative. How narrative is sports for you? I mean, like, I know that you love Brock Purdy, you know, this Iowa State guy who's sort of wholesome. So, is there a relationship between watching the game as a statistical physical act and the narrative act of enjoying it?
Such a fascinating story. Yeah, I mean, question. And we're all fascinated by the backstory. Apart from listening to the NFL under the bedclothes as a little boy, when I was back here in California, I grew up, and this is true of many in our generation, on Vin Scully, the great baseball announcer, and Chick Hearn, the great basketball announcer. And they were the voices of my youth. You know, I was an only child in often a lonely house with my parents away, and those were the guys who kept me company. And Vin Scully was the great narrator of all time. I mean, he was a lyric poet. Essentially, because baseball is a slow-moving game, when somebody came up to the plate, he would just spin beautiful monologues that stretched from ancient Greek drama to what goes on in a Saturday night. So he certainly, I mean, baseball is suited to narrative. And your question actually reminded me, I've always wanted to answer that New York Times book review question, what is your guilty pleasure as a reader? And my answer would be sports autobiographies. So I remember reading Jerry Kramer's book. I think he was on the Packers way back when, probably in that first Super Bowl team. Of course, Andre Agassi and Jim Boughton, and there's so many classics, fewer from the NFL perhaps that I've encountered. But so I love the narrative of, let's say, Andre Agassi as a two-year-old boy being forced to hit the tennis ball against the wall in his back garden in Las Vegas by his Iranian immigrant father, hating the game and going on to become one of its great players. So, how to stitch disparate moments into a narrative is probably what you and I have to do as writers. And sports is an interesting kind of lab for doing that. I mean, I'm thinking when we're talking about Sports Illustrated, I lived in Boston for 4 years, and that certainly has my vote as the greatest sporting town I've ever been in. Though I was in Pittsburgh last week, and they might put in quite a claim too. But one of the beauties of Boston was, again, the Boston Globe had all these amazing writers, many of whom in the sports section, many of whom went on to Sports Illustrated, Bud Collins and Lee Montville, and just an all-star team. So reading about sports is almost as good as following them. And probably that's why I was so thrilled at Time Magazine. My most memorable gig, as you mentioned, was getting to cover the Olympics 6 times. And I was the guy responsible for all 26 sports in the Summer Games. Less happily, all the sports in the Winter Games. And being in charge of curling and luge was no delight. But I really enjoyed the Summer Games. And seeing actually professional basketball players and tennis players whom I could never see otherwise. So I was there for the first Dream Team with Jordan and Magic Johnson and Charles Barkley. And then I could see Steffi Graf and Agassi and others up close. Because I've never been to one of the major tournaments. We're getting away from the NFL, but we could talk about sports all day, I think.
Well, I was just thinking that like professional wrestling became entirely narrative. That the story is that 100 years ago, wrestling matches were intense but very boring because it was just two men grappling on the mat for hours. And so they literally transformed. I mean, you can read Best American Sports Writing, and literally there are stories about professional wrestling, even though it's fictional these days. And so that's an interesting, I mean, that's almost another podcast entirely about just how narrative overtakes some sports entirely.
I love that. And but before we go on to the next thing, I mean, it reminds me, baseball, especially before the change in rules, was not always such an exciting game. But for example, reading Roger Angel in the New Yorker, 40-page intricate, sinuous articles about the drama and the humanity within a World Series was thrilling. So it was always more exciting to read him on the game, let's say in the 1980s or 90s, than to watch the World Series.
Yeah, well, Ken Burns is another person who really put his mark on the narrative of baseball, and just really made you lean into the narrative aspect of that sport. So
football doesn't have an equivalent, does it? Can you think of anyone who's really good? I mean, the week-to-week announcers are good at what they do, but
no. I listen to a lot of podcasts now. Bill Simmons, he's a big Boston sports fan. I listen to his podcast every week. And then there's Nick Wright. He's a ESPN. I think he's ESPN, but he's a huge Chiefs fan. And so he has very, very biased commentary, but he's usually right because the Chiefs usually pull it out. It's funny how, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. And now maybe it's podcasters and YouTubers who might be changing how we relate narratively to sports. But there was a time when it was Vin Scully at a Dodgers game, putting pictures in your head over the radio. So it's almost like someone could do a PhD thesis about sort of the technology and the narratives of sports, right?
Yes. Yes. It's interesting. I remember when the New Yorker, in its more imaginative days, they ran a long, long piece, maybe 15 pages, on the light in Los Angeles. So it was mostly in relation to the great artists, the many artists around Venice or whatever who made light their subject. But there, at the climax of the piece, whom did they quote but Vin Scully? Because so often, when he was in the broadcast booth calling a Dodgers game, he'd talk about the sun setting behind the palm trees and the color of the sky behind the mountains. And I loved what you just said, putting pictures to the game. He was the master. He'd learned it on doing radio, I guess, with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And now I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan, who I believe was a sportscaster. And that's how he developed his wonderful, engaging way of telling a story. So you hardly noticed what the substance or the content was. He just had the knack of making you feel comfortable and spinning a yarn. And it reaped huge dividends for him.
Yeah, he was a very narrative president.
I'm curious...
Do you go to many NFL games? Because you were talking about baseball and Vin Scully sort of creating pictures. Baseball to attend is a very different experience than football. I go to Royals games and one Chiefs game a year. And the NFL experience is very intense, but it's just aesthetically different than sitting in a baseball game.
I am so envious of you, Ralph. I have never, never, never been to an NFL game. Seeing 49ers and training camp is the closest I've got. When I used to go to Dodger Stadium, and the funny thing there was 55,000 people in Dodger Stadium, most of them would be listening to Vin Scully while they were watching the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's an incredible thing. Vin Scully would be coming from all directions, and he was sitting above us as in the heavens. And that was an exciting experience, especially because the games were often not exciting. But I've never been to an NFL game. I saw ice hockey once at the Winter Olympics, and I realized how exciting it was. I think there's a sport that doesn't gain by being televised, but when you're there, you can hear the crash against the board, and you really feel it. But no NFL yet.
Yeah, it's funny you're talking about people listening to Vin Scully in the stadium. In Kansas City, we have Danny Matthews. He's been calling the games for as long as there have been Kansas City Royals. And I went to the big wild card game with my dad in 2014 when the Royals beat the A's in 14 innings. And he was listening to Danny Matthews while he was watching the game. And so that's just another technological thing that we interact. Like I was watching Royals Twitter. I was checking Twitter updates, and then he was listening to the radio. So who knows what sorts of technologies will shape the way future generations watch sports.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking that podcasters such as you are the voices in our head and the voices who are dominating our consciousness the way radio announcers were when you and I were kids. So I remember the first week I arrived at Time Magazine, I wanted to make sure I wouldn't be a sort of corporate button-down guy in the Midtown, even though that's what I looked like. So I did two things. I went to Madison Square Garden two times. The first was to see the Grateful Dead, and the second was to see the Lakers. And over my life, I've met some interesting people, and I've never been a kind of real fan. But that was maybe the only time in my life when I saw Chick Hearn, the announcer for the Lakers, and I walked all the way down to the floor to shake his hand and say, "You know, you've meant so much to me. You're the voice that has chaperoned me and serenaded me for all my growing up years." So I didn't get so excited when I met Meryl Streep, but when I met Chick Hearn, my heart was pounding.
Yeah, no, I'm sure if I saw Bill Simmons, I would corner him. I know Wesley Morris, who writes for the New York Times, I actually invited him on my podcast because I'm a fan. I just wanted to talk to him.
Did he say yes?
Yeah, I've talked to Wesley twice.
Wow, fantastic.
Once just about his general career, and then once specifically about the movie Do the Right Thing. But he was I briefly taught at Yale, and he's a Yale graduate. And so it's funny, if you have Ivy League bona fides, then you can sort of call in other people. And so that was my first entree to him. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of him, not necessarily because of his newspaper writing, but because of his podcast interviews. He's just so affable and so smart. And so it's funny who we identify celebrity in, you know.
Yes. Yeah, you're a student of the podcast, and I'm delighted that podcasts have been so successful, because it suggests to me people are longing for intimacy and long-form conversations and the human voice in this world where everything is, you know, a clatter of images. Something in us is crying out for what you're offering, which is, you know, long, deep, close conversations.
Yeah, well, Pico, I know that I need to let you go at the bottom of the hour here, because you probably have other podcasts to be on. You're promoting your terrific book, Aflame. So we'll just end on what's your plan for this year's Super Bowl? Where are you going to watch it? Dare I ask who you're going to root for? What is your Super Bowl ritual going to be this year?
That's a very sensitive subject, Rolf, because I will be back in Japan, and actually I'm involved in a small way in a movie. So I may be on the movie set, in which case there's no chance of my watching it. I may be able to persuade my daughter to sign me up for another free month in a Japanese streaming service. My prediction, and yes, you're right not to want to ask my prediction, but I think it'll be 35-28 in favor of the Eagles. I think that the common theme this week is how everyone's against the Chiefs because they're so formidable, the way the Patriots used to be. I much more dislike the Eagles. I really dislike the Eagles, but I've loved Saquon Barkley since he was at the Giants. And he was kind of my Barry Sanders of the moment and my Detroit Lions, because he was always playing in this terrible team, doing amazing things and being overlooked. So I love Saquon, and I'm not interested in Jalen Hurts and A.J. Brown and the others. But I think maybe Saquon will make the difference this time, insofar as you began by saying correctly, the Chiefs have won in such strange backward ways this year. It's hard to feel really resounding confidence, except that they have it in their blood always to win, it seems.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening. I'll leave you here with my 2002 NPR Super Bowl dispatch from Thailand in its entirety. Here it is.
If you have zero interest in all the Super Bowl hype, you're not alone. Pundits attempting ad nauseum to predict an unpredictable game can get pretty darn tiresome. On the other hand, the Super Bowl is such an American institution at this point. I mean, this is the 36th year of the game, that we can surely dredge up a little sympathy for Americans traveling abroad who can't find a way to watch the game. Rolf Potts knows the disenfranchised feeling. He's been in Asia for 5 years, and he's lived the pain of being in exile without a Super Bowl to watch. I'm asking you to put aside your loathing of all things Super Bowl, if that's where you stand, and try to relate to Rolf and his quest to connect with his memories of home.
For some people, missing the Super Bowl might not seem like that big of a deal. But for me, it's not just a sporting event. Like Christmas and the 4th of July, I see Super Bowl Sunday as a sacred and patriotic holiday. Regardless of which teams are playing, the ritual of watching the game is vital to my sense of cultural tradition. This year, since I'm living off the beaten track in southern Thailand, I'm once again faced with the dismal prospect of missing the Super Bowl. What's more, my expat neighbors don't even sympathize.
Richard, will you watch the Super Bowl this year?
No, I will not watch the Super Bowl.
Why not? Don't you like football?
No, I really don't like football.
Why don't you like football?
Well, I think it's a rather stupid game.
As an American, that sounds a bit like blasphemy. Where I grew up, the NFL was the cultural equivalent of the Greek pantheon. To me, football stars like Joe Montana and Ed Too Tall Jones were like Zeus and Apollo. But NFL icons just don't mean as much to the other travelers I've met in Thailand.
Do you know who Rolf Benerschke is?
No.
He played for the Chargers in the 70s. He was a kicker.
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
He was Norwegian.
Rolf.
Rolf.
Rolf. What's his last name?
Benerschke.
Is that Norwegian last name?
To be honest, my interest in football stars peaked out when I was a kid. But just as you don't have to be a devout Christian to love Christmas, I'm always a faithful football fan come Super Bowl time. My devotion to travel is what complicates things. 2 years ago, I missed one of the most exciting matchups in Super Bowl history because I was off exploring the Egyptian Sinai. Last year, I was at the massive Kumbh Mela festival in India. Over 10 million Hindus bathed in the Ganges that day, but I couldn't find a single soul who even knew what the Super Bowl was, let alone tell me who'd won. Here in southern Thailand, the locals are almost as ambivalent as they were in India.
Will you watch the Super Bowl this year?
The more I ask around, the more it seems like I'm doomed to miss the big game for the third year in a row. Then I remember that my landlady has a satellite dish. Seeing this as my only hope, I march over to her house. At first, she has no idea what I'm talking about, but eventually I pester her into calling the TV station. So this is what it comes down to. One Hail Mary, one long bomb on a safety blitz, one fateful phone call that will spell my destiny. Caught up in the reverie, I envision two possible futures. One, where I blissfully watch Super Bowl 36 and go on to live a happy, productive life. And another, grimmer fate, where I miss the game and forever lose contact with my cultural heritage, exiled from my own past, like Napoleon in the South Atlantic. In a moment, I know my answer.
Yeah, sure. In Thailand, government TV.
It will show the Super Bowl.
Yes, Super Bowl, sure.
All right.
So this Sunday, as you settle into your easy chair with a plate full of buffalo wings and the remote control, I'll be sitting in the glow of my landlady's TV set on the other side of the world. By the time the teams line up for kickoff, the Monday morning sun will be rising over Thailand, and it won't matter what team I root for, because I'll have already won. This is Rolf Potts from Ranong, Thailand, for the Savvy Traveler.